The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to The Dan Proft Show. Thank you for joining us on this installment. Again, please follow us at danproftshow.com. That's where you get podcasts of the program. You can also get podcasts at Spotify and iTunes. Follow us on social media at Dan Proft Show. That's on Facebook and Twitter. Also at Dan Proft is another Twitter account. And on Instagram at Proft Dan. We have a lot to cover today. But Holman Jenkins, writing the Wall Street Journal, suggests something that I've been suggesting since the lockdowns occurred, which is the lockdowns were the black swan, not the viral outbreak. Of course, he does so more eloquently than I, but Holman Jenkins writes, "Our lockdown response was a black swan. We started off sensibly. This is not something American families generally need to worry about," said the CDC's Dr. Nancy Messonnier in mid-January. "It's a very, very low risk to the United States," said Dr. Anthony Fauci a week later. And of course, we know about Nancy Pelosi wanting to party in Chinatown and Bill de Blasio and his public health director in New York City encouraging people to attend the St. Patrick's Day parades and so on and so forth. But something happened. What happened? From Bill Gates to your local editorialist, a new priority waddled to the fore, writes Jenkins. "We decided that whatever contributes to killing Americans at a routine total rate of 8,000 or so a day, it shouldn't be the coronavirus. Accidents, yes, 6% of deaths. Heart disease, yes, 23% of deaths. Flu and pneumonia, yes, 2% of the deaths. These deaths are allowed, but not deaths from coronavirus, even at the cost of economic ruin for millions." Of course, the media and public are free to decide now. They never wanted to flatten the curve. They wanted to be spared the virus altogether. But explain how that is to be done and explain why. This is, what is unprecedented. What is unprecedented is the response. But it's not unprecedented for the left. It's just unprecedented for the country. And I'll explain that a little bit later, because I want to get to a medical view on this to support what Holman Jenkins has written, what I have been saying. And this is from two doctors with emergency room care experience. They are co-owners of Accelerated Urgent Care in Bakersfield, California, and they did this briefing that I'm sure many of you listening have seen because it's gone viral. 5 million views, I think, as of this airing. Doctors Dan Erickson and Artin Masihi, they're doing antibody testing. Coronavirus testing. Their facilities, they own more than a half dozen, have tested 5,200 patients for the coronavirus throughout the county in which they operate, making up for over half of all testing in Kern County, California. Their death rate of coronavirus is similar in prevalence to the flu, they argue. And then they go through chapter and verse on this. The nice thing they do in this briefing, and I think one of the reasons it's gotten so much viewing, is because they start with some first principles, too. Sort of the first principles of immunology and disease control. So here's Dr. Erickson kicking it off.
"Even though everything we've studied about quarantine, typically you quarantine the sick. When someone has measles, you quarantine them. We've never seen where we quarantine the healthy, where you take those without disease and without symptoms and lock them in your home. So some of these things, from what we've studied from immunology and microbiology, aren't really meshing with what we know as people of scientific minds that read this stuff every day.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And some immunology 101 for the layman, like myself.
What I'm seeing is when you take human beings and you say, go into your house, clean all your counters, Lysol them down. You're going to kill 99% of viruses and bacteria. Wear a mask. Don't go outside. What does it do to our immune system? Our immune system is used to touching. We share bacteria, staphylococcal, streptococcal bacteria, viruses. We develop an immune response daily to this stuff. When you take that away from me, my immune system drops. As I shelter in place, my immune system drops. You keep me there for months, it drops more. And now I'm at home, hand washing vigorously, washing the counters, worried about things that are indeed what I need to survive. Let's follow the science. This is immunology, folks. This is microbiology. This is what we've combined together. We have 40 years of experience in this. This is common sense immunology.
So quarantining and social distancing is worse for us, you're saying?
It decreases your immune system. You can't build an immune system by... If someone has a reduced immune system, you hide them away because they can't build an immune system. If you have a normal functioning immune system, you need interaction. When a child's in a womb, you're in this protected environment. When you come out, you have almost no immune system. You develop that through touching your mouth, touching your eyes, virus, bacteria, immune response, IgG, IgM. This is how you build a strong immune system.
You think people are worrying too much?
Of course they are, but that's from media telling them to. I am telling them sheltering in place decreases your immune system. And then as we all come out of shelter in place with a lower immune system and start trading viruses, bacteria, what do you think is going to happen? Disease is going to spike. And then you've got disease spike amongst a hospital system with furloughed doctors and nurses. This is not the combination we want to set up for a healthy society. It doesn't make any sense.
And speaking of not making any sense, the arbitrariness of the rules and guidelines.
For instance, nobody talks about the fact that coronavirus lives on plastics for 3 days, and we're all sheltering in place. Where'd you get your water bottles from? Costco. Where'd you get that plastic shovel from? Home Depot. Those are fomites and carriers of disease. So you take your family sheltering in place that you think is safe, and you're taking fomites with disease that they've shown that lasts 3 days. Are you really protecting yourself from COVID? Does that make sense to you? It doesn't make sense to me. And if I swabbed things in your home, I would likely find COVID-19. And so you think you're protected, but you've got fomites coming from, you know, Home Depot and Lowe's. And it's okay for us to be mingling in those situations, but we have to not go to work. It's okay for us to go to Costco, but not to church. Do you see the lack of consistency here? From a microbiological, immunological standpoint, that doesn't make sense. If you're going to isolate people, you need to shut these all down because that's how the fomites are being transferred.
By the way, Fomites was the name of my college garage band. We were a Pixies cover band. We killed with Here Comes the Man. Continuing on with the with what doesn't make sense from a microbiological perspective, you heard on the cleaning and the isolation. What about on the all-popular masks and gloves?
When you wear gloves that transfer disease everywhere, those gloves have bacteria all over them. I'm wearing gloves. Not helping you. As your mask that you're wearing for days, you touch the outside of it, COVID, and then touch your mouth. This doesn't make any sense. We wear masks in an acute setting to protect us. We're not wearing masks. Why is that? Because we understand microbiology, we understand immunology, and we want strong immune systems. I don't want to hide in my home, develop a weak immune system, and then come out and get diseased. We have both been in the ER through swine flu and through bird flu. Did we shut down for those? Were they much less dangerous than COVID? Is the flu less dangerous than COVID? Let's look at the death rates. No, it's not. They're similar in prevalence and in death rate. So we are saying that our response now that we know the facts, it's time to get back to work. It's time to test people.
And just in sum, Dr. Erickson.
When I look at the basic tenets that we know of microbiology, and I say, do we need to still shelter in place? Our answer is emphatically no. Do we need businesses to be shut down? Emphatically no. Do we need to test them and get them back to work? Yes, we do. The secondary effects that we went over the child abuse, alcoholism, loss of revenue, all these are, in our opinion, a significantly more detrimental thing to society than a virus that is proven similar in nature to the seasonal flu we have every year.
He also added, they both did, that should schools open? Yes. One more thing Erickson said that's just worth noting. This is a bit outside of his lane, but telling nonetheless. It's a fair statement, nonetheless, something to consider. Politicians talking about safety.
Something else is going on here. This is not about science, and it's not even about COVID. When they use the word safe, if you listen to the word safe, that's about controlling you.
This is Dan Pratt.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We ended with Dr. Erickson from Bakersfield, California. His comments about safe, going to make you safe. That's a means to control you. That's not about science. Politico piece on the Ava Perón of East Lansing over the weekend by Tim Alberta. I don't know what happened to Tim Alberta. It is. It should come with a advertisement disclaimer at the top of it. That is how hagiographic this piece is. And he tweeted about it, did Tim Alberta? In Lansing, you cannot find anyone, Republican or Democrat, on the record or off, who does not admire the skills of the state's 49th governor. Moreover, just about everyone likes her. She is genuine, secure, quick to give a hug or share a dirty joke. I mean, I'm flabbergasted. Was that protest in East Lansing and Lansing that we saw the other week a figment of our nation's imagination? But tell me again how, the D.C. press corps and leftist politicians aren't partners, one being the head man to the other. And that goes in both directions. I mean, it's just remarkable. By the way, Governor Whitmer there, the Ava Perón of East Lansing I mentioned, interesting, modified her stay-at-home order substantially and also only extended it to May 15. Compare that to, say, Pritzker in Illinois at May 30, Evers in Wisconsin at May 26, Northam in Virginia at June 10. Huh. You think Whitmer is responding to science, or do you think she's responding to public pressure in the modifications and the relatively short horizon in comparison to some of her brethren? Yeah. Keep you safe. The sort of hysteria, crackpottery, that has been unleashed by these mystics. And that's what these politicians are, as we have gone chapter and verse. I mean, compare how many medical professionals that we've had on this program to the number of medical professionals whose opinions are being given any weight by some of these governors, for example. Let me give you an example of how this plays itself out, the mystics and the fear-mongering. Math teacher, Steinert High School in Hamilton, New Jersey, caught on video this week, was shouting what you're about to hear to a group of teenagers throwing a football around in a park. This is a teacher, high school math teacher, addressing freshman boys throwing a football around in a park.
You can hear me over your music? Park closed. You will get arrested if the cops come.
Wait, can we go over there?
Is that crazy enough for you?
Can we go over there?
Park closed. The whole area. Get it through your thick head. You are the reason we are in this situation. You are the problem. tape recorded. Who are you going to show it to? Post me on social media. You're the idiot doing the wrong thing. I'm just trying to save your life. But die, okay? I hope both of you get the coronavirus. I hope you both die a long, painful death.
I hope you both get the coronavirus and die a long, painful death. She's in the business of saving lives. Until she isn't, apparently, which turns on a dime. I mean, are you kidding? This is thoughtfulness. This is adult leadership. And it's one woman. It's one teacher. I get it. But it's an example of something else that's afoot. A virus, if you will, of fear. Let me give you another example of what's particularly disturbing. City of Winslow, Arizona. Winslow police officers come into the store of Daniel Mazon, a 71-year-old proprietor of the Southwest Indian Arts Center. This just a couple of weeks ago. And this happens as they question why he is open.
Hi, man. How are you?
How are you doing?
Good.
Are we open today?
Absolutely.
Okay. I believe... Yeah. You have already been given a warning about being open, not being open?
I'm in compliance, sir.
How are you in compliance?
I went and I changed my license. I'm not just a souvenir store now.
Okay.
I am a department store. Indian department store. I am
so
handling hay. I am handling hay. I am handling paper towels, food. Dog food. I'm starting. I'm getting a bunch of new stuff.
What kind of food are you handling?
What kind?
Twix, musketeers.
Yeah, anything. And so I'm in compliance. I'm legal, and I have a right to be in business handling these other products. I'm just getting prepared to get a big load of hay. Hay. I got hay over here. I got people coming in to buy it. I'm in compliance. Thank you.
Okay. Can I see your license real quick?
Huh?
Can I see your license?
Sure.
Takes his business license, calls it in.
I don't want you to feel like we're harassing you or anything.
No, but you are.
How?
Because I already talked to the police yesterday. They talked to you about it. Did they say anything to you about it?
Nope.
Yep, that's why we're here.
Huh?
That's why we're here.
Well,
it's because they told us you were reopened after you were told not to be.
No, I changed.
When did this change?
Huh?
When did you get this change?
It doesn't matter when I got it.
So it kind of does.
It doesn't.
So he is trying to wave around his license, saying he's now a department store. Issue date was 3/20.
It's the law, man. I can.
So it says issue 3/24. So. No, it's all snap.
And now comes the ticket.
So.
I get one or two people a day. Corona Bologna.
Corona Bologna.
And look at all the people over there. Look at all the people, you know, everywhere.
Yes.
I mean.
Well, unfortunately, you are getting a citation. I need to take a picture
care.
Of that. I need to take a picture of that.
And
I need to.
This is documentation. It'll be all right.
That's
do you have a driver's license on here?
I'm not driving.
Okay. Tell you what, go ahead and arrest him, put him in handcuffs, and then a search incident to arrest, get your hands out.
Arrested for not giving his driver's license now.
It's called a search incident to arrest. The Supreme Court authorizes that.
If he would
have
just
go ahead and have a seat,
ID,
sir.
Because I don't give you an ID?
So under,
you're under arrest because you're a violation of the health care code. That's the misdemeanor.
You guys are a joke, man.
Under arrest for violation of the health care code. Interpretation of his business license that he changed so that he could stay open and got authorization by the issuing body for the change. Good news there is that the charges were dropped and his business now is allowed to stay open. The bad news is the juxtaposition. In New Jersey, America used to be about those kids playing football in a park. Now it's about that scolding math teacher. In Arizona, America used to be about that 71-year-old store owner. Now it's about a police state. You get your rights from the government. This is Dan Proft. In the city.
listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Going back to our two doctors from Bakersfield, California, whose press conference about what's happening in California and their view of the data, both national and international, has gone viral. Doctors Erickson and Masihi. Dr. Masihi, on social distancing, what made sense initially and what makes sense now?
So I guess that's what I'm trying to wrap my head around. Like, why is that?
It was needed initially.
Are they lying?
It was needed initially. They actually, we both agree with exactly what they did initially because we didn't know. It was an unknown. Now it is becoming known. Initially, when you don't know something, you're extra careful because you're fearful. It's just like when you see a patient and they're very sick, you test for everything because you're scared. You're fearful. But then as you see more of those patients, you realize, hey, I know what to test for, right? It's shotgun effect versus sniper effect, right? So initially when this data came out of a new virus that's lethal, they went all out. And I think that was appropriate. But now that we have the data, we're seeing that 96, 97% of patients completely recover. And those four patients that die, they have over 90% comorbidities. Let's run through that one more time. Out of 100 people, if 96 do fine, the four that die, 90% of those four have comorbidities: heart failure, emphysema, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus. They're on immunomodulating medications. They're immunodeficient, HIV. These are the people that are dying. You get some healthy people that die, but that's an infinitesimal number.
And to that end, when we talk about reopening America, we're not just talking about the private sector business. We're also talking about private and public sector education, including at the higher ed level. What's a good model to follow for reopening a college or university near you, or one that your son or daughter attends? Well, I can't think of a better person to ask than my man, Mitch Daniels, former Indiana governor and president, now president of Purdue University. Mitch Daniels, thanks so much for joining us. And so, based on what you heard from Dr. Masihi and the letter that you wrote to the people of Purdue, it seems like you're sort of operating on the premise that they've laid out, which is to say we recognize who is most susceptible to COVID-19 and who isn't, and we're going to resume life on campus at Purdue. It's going to be a little bit different, and we're going to make sure to protect those people we know are most susceptible.
Well, it's our intention, Dan, to resume. We think we owe it to our students. Tens of thousands of them have said they want to be here. They want to continue their education. And if we can possibly do that under conditions that we believe are safe for all, then we think it's our duty to do that. Yes, what the doctor has said has become more and more clear as the data has accumulated, but there's an additional factor that's very relevant to us. If you were to look at that data with regard to the younger people, that is, pick a number, 50 and under, 40 and under, 35 and under, the fatality almost disappears completely. It's even smaller than the numbers he gave, which were for all adults. And here at Purdue and in our surrounding community of West Lafayette, because of the university, we have one of the youngest populations in the country. West Lafayette, including the surrounding residential areas, is the fifth youngest in the country. The median age is 21 and a half. And 82% of our whole campus community, students, faculty, staff, everyone, 82 or more percent are under 35. So we think we have possibilities to resume to be not different, but very different fashion this fall. And a principal goal of the changes we make will be to protect our faculty, our staff, and any who do have those other conditions the doctor talked about, protect them from getting this virus if we can.
How has the Purdue community responded to this letter that you wrote?
Overwhelmingly positive, if we can measure just based on the feedback that's come in so far. Let me just say a word about the personality of our university. We're known for engineering and science, we've always said that whatever a student studies here, we want them to leave as a problem solver. We want them to leave with the ability to think through a challenging situation and try to help produce a constructive, successful answer. And so when we look at a situation like this, we'll approach it very carefully, of course, but it's in the nature of this place to not to run from it, but to take it on and see if we can't find a real world answer.
When we come back with Mitch Daniels, I want to ask how he plans to protect the very valuable interpersonal connections on campus under the new protocols. More with Mitch Daniels, president of Purdue University, when we return.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Mitch Daniels, president of Purdue University. And Mitch, I want to go back to what you understand to be true and what is coming into clearer focus. I mean, the idea of a bunch of 20-year-olds around enjoying each other's company in whatever setting, whether it's at a football game or in a frat or sorority, there's an infinitesimal chance of sickness, much less anything worse.
Well, that's what the data seems to be saying. I mean, obviously, people can get this. As we know, it appears high percentages, maybe a significant majority of young people, never know they had it,
right.
Or if they do, it's mild. But of course, we also know that within limited populations, older and especially those who are already suffering from an illness of some kind, it is nothing to mess around with. And so we have to structure things if we can with that reality in mind. I'm just saying that although our campus environment has the problem of density, we have purposely brought people close together for very good academic reasons. That's now the enemy. On the other hand, our demography, the age distribution, gives us maybe a chance to manage this in a way that's very different than, let's say, a nursing home.
I hear what you're saying, too, about trying to strike this balance. But, I mean, you're more than a university president. You're more than a governor. You're a thoughtful guy and big thinking, not just the thinking in the moment. And I just wonder, to me, it seems that the two keys to life, to a life well lived, intellectual connections and interpersonal connections. And I would assume that you would be trying to guard jealously the value of interpersonal connections.
Yes, absolutely. And it's clear that our students feel the same, and I think they're right. Listen, you know, Purdue's been a step or two out front in trying to use the tools of the digital age to become more efficient and to help educate those, for instance, working adults who can't come to a campus. But there's a real value, we think, a very important value in those interpersonal experiences, and we're determined to preserve them for our students starting this fall if we can possibly in good conscience do that.
Let me ask you this, Governor Daniels, University President Daniels. Just a general, I'm not asking you to address any governor in particular, but react to this statement, if you would. It's mine. If you elect people who don't believe in God, don't be surprised when your God-given rights get no respect and provide no restraint. Do you think you've seen that happen around this country during this pandemic?
I'm not sure that's the way I diagnose it. I will say that two things. One, I'm awfully glad, I think we should all be right now, that we have a federal system, because this phenomenon is very different in different places. Trying to dictate it a single solution or set of solutions centrally is almost never a good idea, and it's certainly not in a case like this. And secondly, I do think that governors and people in responsibility like that have to think about the whole community and the long term. And so there's a risk always that people will overreact to the immediate moment or see the political rewards only in doing things that are short term and seem popular now and don't fully weigh and balance all the interests for which a person in that role is responsible.
Just on the going back to the college front, do you think universities with multi-cajillion dollar endowments should be taking millions of dollars in CARES Act funding, like, say, University of Notre Dame taking $5.8 million in funding through the CARES Act? This is your opportunity to take a shot at Notre Dame.
I don't want to do it. I don't like doing that. They're a fine institution. We're proud to be their neighbor. Well, I think it's a decision for each, just as it was for each business in the productive or for-profit sector. I think it's a call for each school. But obviously, whether we're talking about individuals or institutions, this is borrowed money. This is printed money. This is debt we're going to dump on the very young people that we're trying to educate here and elsewhere. And so we ought to be very careful about it, not overdo it, and it ought to go on the basis of need to the extent it possibly can.
Yeah, you spoke, I remember the speech that you gave about the Red Menace back, it's almost a decade ago now when you were considering running for president, and the Red Menace being red ink. And good gosh, I wonder what you're thinking about what you've seen and where we're at now with the CBO projecting debt at 101% of GDP for by the end of the year.
It's discouraging. I'm not faulting in this emergency, the authorities doing what they did. I'll give you the analogy, Dan, that has come to my mind. Lots and lots of smart people have said over recent years, hey, the Federal Reserve ought to keep some ammunition in reserve. That is to say, they should not lower rates so low that they can't go any lower and that they can't, they don't have much of an option in time of trouble. Well, I have the same view on the fiscal side. If we had been conducting ourselves responsibly, if we, in this boom we've been through, if we had balanced our budget or come close to it, then if you have to splurge like this, it would be a little less worrisome, it seems to me. We didn't do that. And so the trillions that they're printing now or that they're spending now are coming on top of trillion-dollar deficits, and I think we're doing a real injustice long-term to, again, to the future generations.
One less known aspect of your biography outside of Indiana is that you had a private sector career, too. You were an executive at Eli Lilly, and I wonder if you're pleased that Big Pharma is being recast in the mind of the public right now in terms of a sector of innovation and aiding people who are ailing, saving lives, rather than just as a whipping boy for politicians?
I am. I did spend a good bit more time in private life than I have in public, and I was thrilled, really, for the chance to work at a company like that, that we were in the business of saving lives and improving them, and I've always been proud of that. No, I think that it is important to see, and hopefully it will remind people that cures and miracles of the kind we've come to take for granted don't just appear magically. It takes billions of dollars, especially the way we force them to do it in this country, to produce a new medication or a vaccine. And, you know, maybe one, I think one thing that may come out of this terrible experience is that all over society we'll identify things that we didn't need to do in the first place, that we managed to get by without. And maybe some of the, I think, excessive regulation and requirements in the medical space could be part of that.
He is former Indiana governor and current Purdue University president, Mitch Daniels. Mitch Daniels, thanks so much for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Take care. Thanks.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And with Homeland, the series finale concluding on Sunday night, so that series is over, I need something else to watch. So Trump can't cancel his task force briefings. At least as long as the insanity persists. So I need the president to get back to. I understand Melania's birthday on Sunday, so took the day off. I understand needing a mental health break from the press corps on Saturday. That's fine, but he needs to get back to it. He just needs to be a little bit more disciplined because there are people who have his back. Dr. Birx certainly did over the weekend. in response to the hysteria over what admittedly was not properly fully formed thoughts that allow the media to take and run with something ridiculous as they did with this whole drink bleach, ingest Lysol business. Joe Biden tweeting over the weekend, I can't believe I have to say this, but please don't drink bleach. I can't believe you do either. It's a real sad commentary on the Biden voter, isn't it, Joe? Dr. Birx with Jake Tapper pressed on this lunacy about people with common sense drinking bleach, concerns about that, had this to say.
It bothers me that this is still in the news cycle because I think we're missing the bigger pieces of what we need to be doing as an American people to continue to protect one another. And we should be having that dialogue about asymptomatics. We should be having that dialogue about this unique clotting that we're seeing. And, you know, we're the first country that really had young people to this degree. Italy and Europe is about 8 years older than us as a median age. So this is the first experience of this virus in an open society, where we really can understand what's happening to every different age groups. These are the things that we should be talking about and focusing on. So I think as a scientist and a public health official and a researcher, sometimes I worry that we don't get the information to the American people that they need when we continue to bring up something that was from Thursday night. So I think I've answered that question. I think the president made it clear that physicians had to study this. I think I've made it clear that this was amusing, as you described, but I want us to move on to be able to get information to the American people.
Yeah, imagine that. Get information of substance to the American people so they have the proper context and consequences associated with different policy choices to make more informed decisions rather than just be beset by fear. But see, the media understands the same thing that so many Dem Pauls understand, which is that if you have somebody afraid, they will give up and do almost anything to stop being afraid. So get back to the briefings, Mr. President. Just be a little bit tighter with them. That's all. For my listeners, for a limited time only, use the discount code SAVE25 for 25% off No Safe Spaces. This is the documentary put together by our colleague, my colleague and our friend, Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla, that looks at free speech and the assault it is under in America on social media platforms, on college campuses, in Hollywood, obviously. Limited time for Danproff Show listeners. Use the discount code SAVE25 for 25% off No Safe Spaces. And you can watch it as many times as you want until May 31 at NoSafeSpaces.com.
From the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Thanks for joining us again. Follow us at danproftshow.com where you get podcasts as well as you can get them on iTunes and Spotify. Also on social media at Dan Proft Show on Twitter, on Facebook, at Proft Dan on Instagram. And we begin this hour with former chief of neuroradiology at Stanford University Medical Center, Dr. Scott Atlas, who wrote that op-ed we discussed last week. He wrote it to thehill.com. I tweeted it out at Dan Proft Show if you want to get it. But he reiterated some of the key points in an interview over the weekend with Martha McCallum on Fox News, starting with his call to end isolation.
Well, I mean, I think we're in a different position now than we were a month ago. And that position is we have a lot of evidence. We don't need to just simply emphasize hypothetical projections. We can combine that empirical data. Instead of ignoring it, we can combine that with our knowledge of fundamental biology. For decades, we've known a lot about viruses, a lot about infections, and for decades, even about this family of viruses. And then we can thoughtfully combine that evidence with the way to restore the country in a safe way.
That seems like a good framework. And what do we know about lethality now, a month removed, as Dr. Atlas was describing?
The overwhelming majority of people do not have any significant risk of dying. This is shown all over the world. And in fact, what induced the panic was this overestimation of what's called the fatality rate of the infection by the World Health Organization. But in reality, it's a fraction. So if you take the number of people who are going to die and you divide it by the people who are infected, they got 3 to 5% of people, which is very high. But now we know from data all over the world, including the U.S., that a massive number of people have the virus that were either asymptomatic. In fact, 50% of people that are infected have zero symptoms. And then another large percentage have nothing really significant that demands any medical care and certainly not hospitalization. So when you look at the newer data that has come out, the estimates are that the fatality rate is very low, maybe 0.1%. I mean, it's not set, it's not known exactly, but these are estimates.
And so what should we do now with what we know now?
I mean, these are significant underlying conditions. If you're young and otherwise healthy, you have essentially zero risk of dying and a very, very low risk, as the second point, of being hospitalized, because the policies are directed to stop people from dying and to prevent overcrowding. And we know that protecting the at-risk population will prevent hospital overcrowding. I mean, that's really very critical. If you're under 18 in New York, you make up 0.6% of the hospitalizations. And if you're over 60, you make up 2/3. So there's a very significant targeted population here. We need to protect them. Yeah. That doesn't need total isolation.
Mm-hmm. And John Ioannidis giving a weekend interview at the Wall Street Journal to Alicia Finley. It was very good. He's a professor at Stanford School of Medicine. He predicted back in March in an article for Stat News that the COVID-19 was going to be far less deadly than modelers were assuming. And of course, he was banished for making such a prediction. And he it turned out to be right then, and he's right now when he said this. There's some sort of mob mentality here operating that they just insist this has to be the end of the world, and it has to be the sky is falling. It's attacking studies with data based on speculation and science fiction, but dismissing real data in favor of mathematical speculation is mind-boggling. We have real data, and you have the shutdown politicians dismissing the actual data for their models. It is remarkable. For more on how remarkable it is, we're pleased to be joined again by John Hinderaker, president of Center of the American Experiment, contributor to powerlineblog.com. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, glad to be with you, Dan.
So what about what has been suggested by Doctors Atlas and Professor Ioannidis, which is isolate the at-risk and free the non-at-risk?
You know, it's so interesting, Dan. Here in Minnesota, where I live, more than 75%. Well, first of all, our governor shut everything down, draconian order, based on a model that said that without a shutdown, there would be 74,000 deaths just here in Minnesota. And with the shutdown, there would be 50,000 deaths just here in Minnesota. In reality, not 50,000, but so far, 278 deaths. And more than three-quarters of them have been either in nursing homes or assisted living facilities. And the whole state has been shut down. And one of the ironies, Dan, is those people aren't being protected. If our governor had closed the nursing homes and done nothing else, we would today have fewer fatalities. So these shutdown orders are just outrageous. They're destroying our economy. But what that means is they're damaging hundreds of millions of lives. And at this point, it's hard to see any purpose to it.
Well, it's funny, too, because Bret Stephens, writing the New York Times, Bret Stephens, never Trumper. So this is not somebody like rallying to the defense of necessarily politicians who want to open up just because they're because it's Trump or because they're Republicans. He wrote, Americans are being told they still must play by New York rules with all the hardships they entail, despite having neither New York's living conditions nor New York's health outcomes. This is bad medicine, misguided public policy, and horrible politics.
Well, it absolutely is, Dan. And of course, what we're all asking ourselves in one shutdown state after another is when does it end? You know, when can people go back to work, go out to eat, you know, all those things, go to a baseball game? And a lot of governors are saying, well, we have to keep testing and testing and testing until we have God knows how many tests, you know, and the case rate drops and we can identify people who have the virus and isolate them and contact trace them, which is a ridiculous program, Dan, because the reason why the case number keeps rising is because we keep doing more tests. You know, the majority of people who test positive for COVID-19 have no idea that they've had it. In fact, there have been some studies just released now done in prison populations in four states where 96% of the prisoners who testified positive were asymptomatic, surprised to learn that they had had the disease. So the idea, unless you test every person every day and somehow, you know, make all the ones who tested positive stay home, this is obviously a fantasy, you can't do that. You can test and test and test, and all you're going to find out is that, you know, more and more people will be identified who have had the disease. So what?
This was a question that the former top Swedish epidemiologist asked when he was watching all of these Western European countries go to full lockdown. He asked the question, how are you going to open back up? How do you walk it back? And it seems to me that there's a lot of governors, particularly, I don't want to politicize it, but you just have to look at the political fault lines, particularly Democrat governors that don't know how to walk it back or don't want to. I don't know which.
Well, I think you're exactly right, because the reality is the virus is out there in the population. You know, we don't know exactly what percentage have already had it, but estimates run from like 12% to 25% of Americans have already had the virus or have it currently. And we're not going to stamp it out. You know, it can't be done. And so inevitably, when a given state lifts its shutdown order and people are out and about and they're eating in restaurants, and going to bars and, you know, playing in the park or whatever, inevitably, more people are going to catch the disease. And then there's going to be another wave of panic, right? And I think a lot of these governors have got themselves into a situation with the shutdown that they don't know how to get out of.
Right, because
and I think one thing going on is that nobody, you know, of these, especially of these, you know, blue state governors, no one wants to go first. And I think they're all kind of looking at each other and saying, well, maybe if we kind of do this all together, you know, no one of us can be blamed.
Although
I think that's probably what's going on. They know at this point the shutdowns don't make any sense. The original idea was flattening the curve, you know, so the hospitals wouldn't be thronged with COVID-19 patients. Well, that didn't happen, right? That was just based on bad models and bad predictions.
Although you
and
have,
so now it's really hard to see any point at all to the shutdown.
And you have Jared Polis in Colorado, Democrat governor, beginning the reopening, but I guess that's not enough. But I think you're right, though, about they know that when you open back up, you're going to see more cases. So then how do I not yo-yo without being a hypocrite? How do I not then shut it down again if the caseload is as big or approximately as big as the caseload we're experiencing when we open up? They painted themselves into corners, what I'm saying.
No, I think you're right. And on that logic, of course, the shutdown goes on forever. And,
right.
And that would cause far, far more damage than the virus could ever cause. You know, it's really interesting. I've been looking at the overall mortality statistics on the CDC website. And through early April, when they were last updated, there were actually 37,000 to 38,000 fewer deaths in the United States recorded by the CDC than the same time period a year ago. Now, I don't think COVID-19 is saving lives, Dan. That's obviously not true. It's a disease. It is certainly killing some people. There's no question about that. But its impact is so slight that you can't even find it looking at the overall mortality statistics in the United States. And that's been true in most other countries as well.
I want to talk about those mortality statistics, talk about lies, damn lies, and statistics. Let's talk mortality rates and data when we come back with John Hindraker. He is the president of the Center of the American Experiment, contributor to powerlineblog.com. More with John right after this.
With the Sultans. With the Sultans.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Illinois' top doc, Dr. Zeki is her name, head of the Department of Public Health here in the state of Illinois, where I am at. And she perhaps gave the most honest, perhaps accidentally, most honest answer about how states and thus nationally we're counting COVID-19 deaths. Listen to what she had to say.
To be clear in terms of the definition of people dying of COVID. So the case definition is very simplistic. It means at the time of death, it was a COVID positive diagnosis. So that means that if you were in hospice and had already been given, you know, a few weeks to live, and then you also were found to have COVID, that would be counted as a COVID death. It means that if technically, if even if you died of a clear alternate cause, but you had COVID at the same time, it's still listed as a COVID death. So everyone who's listed as a COVID death doesn't mean that that was the cause of the death, but they had COVID at the time of death. I hope.
It's a remarkable statement. Why would that be the guideline? Well, perhaps Nancy Pelosi indicated why it would be the guideline in her interview with Jake Tapper over the weekend about the forthcoming effort to get states and localities money for COVID-19.
We have said for the working on, we've been working on CARES too, and on that we are including not only the outlays that they have for the coronavirus, but also the loss of revenue that they have.
Outlays and loss of revenue, all things COVID-19. John Hindraker, powerlineblog.com contributor, president of the Center of the American Experiment, back with us. Well, what about that, John, the classifications, because there's money attached to those classifications?
Well, that's absolutely right. As usual, if you look at financial incentives, you're likely to find the answer to the question. And a number of doctors, Dan, have complained that they're being pressured to classify more and more deaths as COVID-19 deaths, whether that virus actually had anything to do with the person dying or not. And one simple way of seeing this, Dan, and I'm very familiar with the statistics in my state, but I know they're similar in every state. Here in Minnesota, more than three quarters of those who allegedly have died from COVID-19, who are included in the total, were residents either of nursing homes or assisted living facilities. And the median age of those that have been chalked up as COVID-19 deaths is 83. And so what's really happening when you look at the numbers is that people who were probably already dying of something else, if they happen to, and you don't have to test positive anymore either, by the way. That was the original standard. Now, you know, if you haven't been tested, but you have some symptoms consistent with COVID-19, which is what, a cough? I mean, I don't know. You know, it's a very, you know, broad range of respiratory symptoms. Now they can classify you as in the COVID-19 category. So I think what we're seeing here is a push to try to attribute as many deaths as possible to this virus, because I think a lot of politicians, frankly, are embarrassed that their predictions haven't come true and they've devastated our country.
Yeah, and you know, I hate to get into the business of arguing about cause of death. It's sort of it's ghoulish business, but because so much is predicated on the numbers you see on the cable news channel tickers, you have to address it. And the point about nursing homes that you make is such a salient one. I think this still is an underreported story, even with 50% of the deaths in Massachusetts now coming from long-term care facilities. We've seen the data in Europe, Western European countries, anywhere from half to two-thirds in a handful of Western European countries, long-term care facilities, as you were saying before. And this report out that, again, received very little attention late last week, ABC7, the New York affiliate, 75% of long-term care facilities were found to not have proper plans in place to prevent disease spread in nursing homes, you know, not compliant. Those are state level issues. So now how do you want to blame Trump for that? Or how do you want to bail out states because their inspections were not done for nursing homes and their nursing homes didn't have the proper preparedness? This is all still a federal problem. This is all still run to the federal government and saying we're doing everything we can at the state and local level and you need to give us money, when the evidence suggests you weren't. And we see this from the body counts at these long-term care facilities.
You know, that's one of the huge ironies, Dan. I mean, again, my state, I think, is pretty typical, maybe extreme, but probably pretty typical. You know, how hard is it to shut down a nursing home? I mean, seriously. These people want to do millions and millions and millions and millions of tests. Well, forget about that. Why don't they just test the people who work in nursing homes? You know, that would take care of 50 to 75% nationwide of all of the alleged COVID-19 fatalities. But they won't do that. It's just bizarre how our governors refuse to act on the data that's right in front of their eyes.
Let me ask you more of a philosophical question. We know the response to this is unprecedented. The viral outbreak is not unprecedented, but the response is unprecedented. Quarantining the healthy, as the Bakersfield, California doctor said, that's new.
Right.
That's new. why the unprecedented response, and why has a majority of Americans across the political spectrum gone along with it largely to this point?
That's such a good question, Dan. I don't think I can answer it. I think part of the answer is that we've all kind of gone soft. You know, we're so used to good times, no serious problems. It's been a long time since we were really at war in a way that impacted most Americans. You know, we had the recession in 2009, but, you know, that wasn't that catastrophic a deal. And I think a lot of us have got the expectation, you know, that nothing should go wrong. And if anything goes wrong, it's up to the government to fix it. And then the reality is, this is a disease. You know, it's a disease for which there is no cure, a disease for which there is no vaccine. A lot of us are going to get, I mean, some epidemiologists say that this thing won't run its course until 80% of Americans have contracted it. Now, the vast majority may not even know that they've had it. But so it's a disease. And the reality is, there's not much we can do about it. But people find that very hard to accept. You know, the idea we've got to do something, you know, is really ingrained in people's minds.
Speaking of, you know, modeling and we've got to do something, those CBO numbers out last week and the projections from big banks and financial institutions, their economists about how long it's going to take to get back to where we were pre-pandemic in terms of economic vitality. I would think that those would be sobering, too, in terms of something we got to do something about.
I don't understand, Dan, why these governors can look at this economic situation, which is really starting to crumble. I mean, the food chain, for example, is really starting to fall apart. And that may be where the rubber finally hits the road. But, you know, when you talk about economic damage, then inevitably, you know, I'll get emails from people saying, oh, all you care about is money.
Right,
you know, you're prioritizing the economy
right.
over people's lives. Well, of course, anybody with any sense knows how ridiculous that is. Because, you know, destroying the economy is gonna ruin and in fact end a lot of people's lives. There was a very little noticed news story about a week ago. Somebody at the United Nations forecast that as a result of the shutdowns, not the disease, because children don't get the disease, or at least they don't die from it. They didn't get it, but they don't die from it. But the United Nations has projected that as a result of the shutdowns in the United States and Western Europe, somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 children in the underdeveloped world will die because their economies are impacted. Mm-hmm. You know, typically they're suppliers of raw materials.
Mm-hmm.
And so what about the 200,000 to 300,000 children in the third world? How about their lives?
He is John Hinderaker, president of the Center of the American Experiment, contributor of PowerlineBlog.com. John, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Dan. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Going back to Drs. Erickson and Masihi, these two Bakersfield, California docs, their press conference. That they had, their press avail, that has gone viral with more than 4 million views at this point, going through chapter and verse on the models, the comparison to the flu, country-to-country comparison, lockdown versus no lockdown, immunology 101. It was pretty comprehensive, not that there's not some disagreement, because local health officials in the county in which they operate disagree with some of the conclusions that they've drawn. But here's what Dr. Dan Erickson had to say about, number one, quarantining.
Even though everything we've studied about quarantine, typically you quarantine the sick. When someone has measles, you quarantine them. We've never seen where we quarantine the healthy, where you take those without disease and without symptoms and lock them in your home. So some of these things, from what we've studied from immunology and microbiology, aren't really meshing with what we know as people of, you know, scientific minds that read this stuff every day.
And then using the model they know best, because they've been involved in some of the antibody testing in their community, California.
What is materializing in the state of California is 12% positives. Well, if we have 39.5 million people. If we just take a basic calculation and extrapolate that out, that equates to about 4.7 million cases throughout the state of California, which means this thing is widespread. That's the good news. We've seen 1,227 deaths in the state of California with a possible incidence or prevalence of 4.7 million. That means you have a 0.03 chance of dying from COVID-19 in the state of California. 0.03 chance of dying from COVID in the state of California. Does that necessitate sheltering in place? Does that necessitate shutting down medical systems? Does that necessitate people being out of work?
And just looking at data where the country has been hardest hit, New York City, of the 10,981 deaths, the percentage of those who died with no underlying condition is 0.005. The deaths under the age of 44 with no underlying condition, 0.0008. 73% of all deaths are over the age of 65. 51% of all deaths over the age of 65 with at least one comorbidity. So I know it's been stated, but it doesn't seem to be received in wide swaths of the population that this virus, yes, anybody can get it. But the idea of saying anybody can get it without the context of incidence and lethality is irresponsible. I mean, it's just irresponsible. How do you look at those numbers? There are zero deaths in New York City, 0 to 17 with no underlying condition. Zero. So how do you say a 0 to 17-year-old can get it just like a 75-year-old can get it and then pretend those things are the same? They're not. And people are going to say, well, no, they're saying it's the elderly and those with underlying conditions we need to protect. That's not how it's being received based on the behavior we see from millennials on up the age cohort. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by a medical professional. He is Dr. David Buther. He's a pulmonologist at National Jewish Health. Doctor, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So there's so much flying around, as you well know. You're in the thick of it, too, in terms of information and trying to make sense of it, particularly for laymen like me. How do you present what the challenges that faces us at present?
Well, I think we have to take a big dose of kind of humble pie here, that we really don't know as much as we would like to know about this disease. So a condition like influenza, it may change from year to year, but we just know a heck of a lot about the biology of the disease and the transmission. And one of the challenges here is we have the blindfolds on still. You're just presenting some data, but really we don't know how infectious this is. We're getting a better sense of how dangerous it is. And I think what's scary is that, in our ICUs around the country, we're seeing normal people like you and me dying of COVID-19. You know, this business of chronic condition, we all want to have a fantasy that that's not us. It's somebody else. It's the other person. But the reality is half of us are overweight or obese. That's a condition. High blood pressure, diabetes. And so most people have some chronic conditions. So when we talk about chronic conditions putting you at risk, that's more than half of us.
When we come back with Dr. David Buther, I want to go back to serology as well as the data on people with underlying conditions. More with Dr. David Buther, pulmonologist at National Jewish Health, when we return.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Dr. David Buther, and I want to talk more about the serology. But I just want to go back for a second on what you said about the data and having an underlying condition can be obese, and so it's a lot more than people would like to think. Still, in New York City, all deaths under the age of 44 represent underlying condition, no underlying condition, represent 3.5% of the deaths. So, I mean, I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying, and are you're not saying that, 65 and over, 75 and over is the same as 45 and under?
No, absolutely not. But coming from a critical care doctor and speaking from the inside of the healthcare system, we don't hear from them very much in the media. And these ICUs were overwhelmed in New York. We have doctors in New York that are on the front lines, and we have doctors here in Denver in the ICUs. And we were a little better off here in Denver than they were in New York. But still, we had got really quite close to running out of key equipment and personnel and ability to care. So if you think about this kind of like a pyramid, where the sickest people that are hospitalized are at the top of the pyramid, and the very tip of that pyramid or iceberg are the people in the ICU and the people at high risk of death. Even if we have a ton of people that get infected with mild cases, that tip of the pyramid is what can overwhelm the healthcare system. And, you know, if you overwhelm the healthcare system, what you have is people, you know, toughing out their heart attack at home and dying because they're afraid to come in or not being able to take care of the routine sort of medical conditions that we have. And so this entire system has been really all about not overwhelming the healthcare system, which is quite fragile and quite overwhelmed in a normal day. You add the pandemic to it, and all of a sudden we can't take care of people. So,
even if
it's a small number, the issue is how do we maintain a functioning healthcare system through this pandemic?
We need to
keep that rate of really sick people at a fairly modest amount over the next 18 months.
And to your point about the people who have other conditions that need treatment not coming, prospectively, that appears to be happening. Cleveland Clinic cardiologist Dr. Steve Nissen, where are the patients? This can't be normal after only 7 patients in the 24-bed coronary care unit came to the Cleveland Clinic on a recent day. The unit is usually full. This is a Yahoo News story. Amid the coronavirus crisis, heart and stroke patients go missing because they have been arguably frightened into not getting the treatment they need. And now you're having a system where, because it's been so COVID focused, the reports all over the country are layoffs, furloughs, salary cuts. So now you're seeing the healthcare infrastructure that you talk about as precarious being undermined just as we're starting to reopen, and you could have the worst of all possible worlds because of the shutdown.
Well, I don't think that's the way I would approach it. I think the issue is that the stay-at-home orders are really kind of an indication of a failure to control the system. This is the bluntest tool we have. And what we're supposed to be doing during this month or two is gearing up our healthcare system, our public health surveillance and tracking system, and our testing. And so kind of the craziness is we may or may not have overreacted to this, but when we open back up, we still have the blinders on. We're still looking 3 miles behind us, and we're hitting the gas on the freeway going 60 miles an hour, not looking 3 miles behind us because we don't have testing. And so I think we still worry. It's a balance, right?
Yeah.
As we start to open up, we need to have the ability to take care of that heart attack patient, that kidney stone. But we also, it's very close to being able to overwhelm all of our critical care capacity with COVID-19. I mean, it's just a tremendous tidal wave that could overwhelm the healthcare system. And we don't want that either.
I was talking to Andrew Bogan, who's a microbiologist, and he was one of the co-authors of the Santa Clara study, which has been, the methodology has been criticized. And he's like, well, fine, that's why we have peer review. Go ahead and criticize it. But with respect to one of the things he said, and I want to get your reaction to this, too, is about herd immunity. It's like, so when you say it could be 2 to 4% of a population in a particular region that may have been infected, so 50 to 85 times the number of reported cases, well, that's still only 2 to 4% of the population. And so I asked him, but that still says there's a whole overwhelming majority of the population that still has exposure risk. And his response was, that's true, but you have to understand, so herd immunity, there's no magic percentage to herd immunity. And so so we don't actually have a hard number, like you have to get to 25%, you have to get to 35%, 45% who've had the virus to get to herd immunity. Is that your understanding as well? And if it is, then how do we know when we're getting close to that place, that place of relative safety, I guess, is the best way I can describe it.
Yeah, I agree, and it's really unclear. People have thrown around 60% of people having to be exposed, and we don't know if that's true, and it depends on each individual virus and the dynamics involved. So I imagine as we open up communities and businesses and we start to see that in the absence of a vaccine, that a positive case does not lead to as much of an outbreak as we would otherwise expect, we would start to believe herd immunity. But that's where this serologic testing can be really, really helpful. So if a business wants to come and open up, it depends on the question you want to answer. If they want to answer, you know, is this employee infected, we'd want to do that molecular PCR test with a nasal swab. But the serology will tell you more, you know, how many of your employees are infected, and maybe what it could tell you is in a certain area, like the cafeteria. Cafeteria workers have a higher prevalence of, you know, serologic positivity. I'm just making that up. But if you found that, well, then you need to put more measures in that area. One of the things that we're seeing is just an overwhelming demand for our blood test to see whether or not somebody's been infected in the past from the community. And I think what's happened is people have been so scared and so panicked, and they've also made up a fantasy that that little mild sniffles that they had back in February or March must have been a mild case of COVID-19, and now they're immune.
Right.
What they're finding out is that the serology ends up often being negative, which is a pretty good sign they have not been exposed or infected. And we're kind of bursting their bubble a little bit, but that might be good. It might be good for people not to assume, you know, that we've all been infected, because actually a fairly small number of people have been infected with COVID-19 at this point. We're all still very susceptible.
He is Dr. David Buther, pulmonologist at National Jewish Health. Dr. Buther, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Take care.
Dan Prof. Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof. Show. I mentioned in our conversation with John Hinderaker from PowerlineBlog.com, the CBO numbers out on Friday that are, you know, fairly daunting. Now, again, CBO and their modeling, take that in the same context you take so much epidemiological modeling. They've often been far off, but they're sort of in the same ballpark as a lot of the big banks and industry analysts. And we'll get to the CEO of one of the biggest banks, Brian Moynihan, Bank of America, in just a second. But CBO, inflation-adjusted GDP is expected to decline by 12% during the second quarter of this year. Unemployment rate expected to average close to 14%. Three-month T-bills, 10-year Treasury notes expected to average 0.1% and 0.6%, respectively. Federal budget deficit projected to be $3.7 trillion for fiscal year 2020. Federal debt held by the public, as I mentioned with Mitch Daniels earlier in the program, 101% of GDP by the end of the fiscal year. It was pretty daunting. Brian Moynihan, who was on Face the Nation over the weekend on Sunday, had some notes of optimism. The two things that he's looking at, one is just talking about Bank of America's analysis, their economists' analyses, and what they see in terms of when we get back to positive growth and when we get back to pre-pandemic economic strength.
First of all, the base assumptions for that 5 weeks ago changed pretty dramatically. There was sort of a low growth U.S. Now it's a negative 6% in our case, our experts' estimates, and plus 6% in 21. But the key is to understand the quarterly flow of that. So it's a deep recessionary environment in the second quarter, a less deep in the third quarter, and then growth in the fourth quarter. So it's minus 30, minus 9, plus 30 on an annualized basis, and then grows next year double digits and then works its way down to single digits. So in effect, that's one thing to think about. Is this a deep recession and back out? And there's great debate about how that works, but our estimates, our experts think it's late next year when the economy gets back to the same size it was prior to this.
Late 2021, he also suggested that the free fall is being blunted by some of what the federal government has done that is starting to take effect, and it's pointing to some reason to be optimistic about consumer spend.
And it's starting now to grow in certain areas, especially as you see it kind of hit bottom. So one of your earlier guests is in an entertainment business. That's still very far down. But other businesses are starting to come on after the first round of provision buying, which was a flood of activity. You're now seeing that level out. That actually provides some hope that as the economy opens up in pieces and safely, you'll see that consumer spending continue to grow, which will help fuel the U.S. economy. And so that's the second piece to keep aware of is first the economic projections, but secondly, the cash flow and the stimulus, the PPP, the unemployment, the $1,200 EIP payments, all those things are going in the economy, and we're starting to see the effect of those.
Yeah, and the effect, though, would be blunted. The stopping the free fall would start the free fall if states were going the direction of Illinois and Wisconsin and Virginia and burying their heads in the sand. Thankfully, most states are not. But the key ultimately is phased in reopening of the economy. You just can't get around it. You have to have an operational private economy. To borrow from Dan Henners with the Wall Street Journal again, economic suicide is not normal behavior.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Doctors Erickson and Masehi, who we mentioned earlier in the show, these are the gentlemen from Bakersfield, California, whose video, a press briefing on all things COVID-19 related, has gone viral. I think it's approaching 5 million views as we talk here. One of the things that Dr. Dan Erickson did was distill down their view and understanding of the difference between locking down and not locking down. And they used an example that we've talked about on this show before, which is Sweden versus Norway. Similar population demographics in terms of homogeneity, Nordic countries, different approaches. Norway on lockdown, Sweden, perhaps the least locked down country in the Western world through this viral outbreak. Here's what Dan Erickson had to say.
Norway has lockdown, Sweden does not have lockdown. What happened in those two countries? Are they vastly different? Did Sweden have a massive outbreak of cases? Did Norway have nothing? Let's look at the numbers. Sweden. Sweden has 15,322 cases of COVID. They did 74,600 tests, which is 21%, similar to the other countries, 21% of all those tested came out positive for COVID. What's the population of Sweden? About 10.4 million. So if we extrapolate out the data, about 2 million cases of COVID in Sweden. They did a little bit of social distancing. They would wear masks and separate. They went to schools. Stores were open. They were almost about their normal daily life with a little bit of social distancing. They had how many deaths? 1,765.
And Norway?
Norway. It's next door neighbor. This is where I come from. These are two Scandinavian nations. We can compare them as they are similar. Let's look at the data. Norway, 7,191 cases of COVID. Total COVID tests, 145,279. So they came up with 4.9% of all COVID tests were positive in Norway. Population of Norway, 5.4 million. So if we extrapolate the data as we've been doing, which is the best we can do at this point, they have about 1.3 million cases. Now, their deaths as a total number were 182, fairly small, but statistically insignificant from 1,700, you realize. Millions of cases, small amount of deaths. 1,700, 100, these are statistically insignificant. So you have a 0.003 chance of death as a citizen of Norway and a 97% recovery. Their numbers are a little bit better. Does it necessitate shutdown, loss of jobs, destruction of the oil company, furloughing doctors?
Good questions. And one other unique characteristic of Norway versus Sweden, which is important to note and was noted by Dr. Johan Giesecke, the former top epidemiologist for the country of Sweden. Norway, the long-term care facilities are much smaller. Sweden, they're much bigger. And we know, as we talked about earlier in the show, what the percentage of deaths emanating from long-term care facility is in the Western world from really the U.S. right now, I would say at a low of 20%, although I think that is under some question when you have states like Massachusetts with 50%. But let's just take it at given 20% to Western European countries at half to two-thirds of deaths coming from long-term care facilities. So that's something else to factor in, the Norway-Sweden comparison, even though Dr. Erickson didn't factor it in, and he still finds the data to be not statistically significant, lockdown versus no lockdown. Somebody else who's also looked at this question of lockdown versus no lockdown is Wilfred Riley. He's an associate professor of political science at Kentucky State University, as well as author of Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. Will, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dan. Good to be back.
So you wrote a piece for Spiked in which you did a bit of number crunching and data analysis, too. You ran a regression analysis on lockdown versus no lockdown. And what did you find?
Yeah, Spiked has been doing a lot of writing about kind of the empirical logic of these coronavirus shutdowns from a British perspective and to a lesser extent from an American perspective. And I wrote essentially an empirical article for them that just took a simple quantitative look at whether the lockdowns seem to be working. And what I find, very similar to Dr. Erickson's comment, I mean, I want to be cautious, but I don't see any statistical significance here. That's pretty much what I find. I mean, the first thing that I do is just look bluntly at whether there are more deaths and more cases in non-lockdown states. So as you know, there are seven U.S. states that decided never to officially lock down, eight if you count Oklahoma. But I mean, pretty good-sized states, Nebraska, Utah, South Carolina for some time. They did eventually adopt a partial order, et cetera. And so I simply took that set of states, South Dakota, and looked at whether more people experienced or died from COVID there. And in fact, that wasn't the case at all. In the social distancing states, you had an average of 1,613 cases at the time I did my analysis across that set of eight states and 33 deaths from COVID-19. And the second figure is still pretty close. In the states that did pursue a lockdown strategy, you had an average of 8,408 cases and 342 deaths. So the next objection might be, well, the social distancing states are a little smaller. What are deaths per million? So I ran that analysis in STATA, the stats program, and found pretty much the same thing. You got a little closer, but in the lockdown states, you had on average a 1,392 cases per million individuals that you have in that state and 54 deaths. Whereas in the states that simply pursued sort of very well done social distancing, you had 729 deaths per million or cases per million and 12 deaths per million. So, again, not all these differences are significant, but the social distancing states, in fact, did better. And then I ran what's called a regression model, linear regression in STATA, where I adjusted for a number of things. The dependent variables were first cases and then deaths. And the independent variables were a lot of the things we've heard talked about here. So not just population, but population density, median income. I threw in diversity, which was defined as minority population percentage, because we've heard that this virus hits people of color harder, even with income adjusted for. That turned out not to be true at all, by the way. But I threw in age because of the point you just made about elder seniors potentially suffering more here. And as you can see in the Spiked piece, I mean, some things had impact, but strategy, i.e. whether a state went with lockdown or shutdown, did not at all. That was completely statistically insignificant. And I then extend this analysis overseas where I look at Sweden, I look at Japan, I look at nations that did not shut down. And I do caution, obviously, you have to adjust for different response strategies. You have to adjust for cultural differences. Those are both homogenous societies. But in general, you find the same thing. I mean, in terms of cases per million, which I think is one of the best metrics here, if you assume a pretty much equivalent testing, in Sweden, you had 1,309 cases per million when I did the analysis about a week ago. In Norway, you had 1,274. And in Denmark, you had 1,221. So, I mean, those are almost identical numbers. You could argue, you know, slight advantage one way, slight advantage the other, but you're definitely not seeing, you know, charnel houses in the areas that have decided to go with social distancing, with SD instead of lockdowns. And then you get into trade-offs. Obviously, those areas still have an economy.
What about, just going back to what you said before about the whole line of argumentation that this is disproportionately affecting minorities in this country? You said that turns out not to be true.
I don't really see much evidence of that. Now, again, obviously, no one, and any reasonably competent scientist would say this, I mean, no one study is definitive. I mean, mine could be redone with current active cases rather than all cases as a dependent variable. You could throw in some things like date of onset, so on down the line. But in my model, which I think is a pretty well-designed model, you literally had variables representing income, population. And once you adjusted for basic things like income, yeah, diversity in a state had no impact on the number of COVID cases in the state. I mean, I would suspect, this is not a part of my research, but where you have a large working poor white population, I saw the data for Minnesota the other day, the victims were 86% Caucasian, which is actually disproportionately high. Where you have large working poor white populations, you know, a lot of people still going out into the essential workforce who happen to be Caucasian, you would see a disproportionate number of Caucasian, especially male deaths. In cities where a large number of sort of working class males may be people of color, you would probably see a disproportionate percentage of people of color. But at least in this model where you threw in income, no, the race of a state, quote unquote, did not have any effect at all. I mean, you didn't see, for example, Mississippi or New Mexico anywhere near the top of those COVID-19 charts.
Important analyses. I'll tweet out Wilfred Riley's piece, which is at spike-online.com, but I'll tweet it out at Dan Prof Show. Will Riley, Associate Professor of Poli-Sci at Kentucky State University, author of Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. Will, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and thinking about proper implementation, management implementation. Right? Here's the emergency response, as we've said many times on this show. Federal support, state management, local implementation. That's been sort of the protocol under the Trump administration and previous administrations. And it's worked out in some places better than others, largely because of state management and local implementation. One such example of what I'm speaking of is exemplified by what Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt had to say over the weekend on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, explaining the basis for Oklahoma entering phase one and beginning the reopening, the formal reopening. They were never technically in shutdown, but the formal reopening of much of their economy starting Friday.
I told Oklahomans we're going to use to through this whole process was the health and safety of Oklahoma is number one, and then mitigate the loss to our economy and get our workers back working as quickly as possible. We're data driven. I can't speak to what's happening in other states, but in my state, we're seeing the trending go down. Our testing's going up. Our tracing. We've put 80 different testing sites up. We've tested over 55,000 folks. Our positive tests right now are 6.3%. And again, 300 hospitalized cases across the state with a capacity for 4,600. We think it's a reasonable time to reopen.
Seems reasonable. In addition to that, and just in terms of being more reasonable and even a greater belief in subsidiarity, the governor has said, hey, mayors and communities that don't want to enter phase one as quickly as I'm issuing guidelines for reentering phase one, like in Normo and Oklahoma, where the mayor's been critical of the governor. Okay, you don't. I'm issuing guidelines from the governor's office, not mandates. Guidelines at the federal level, guidelines at the state level, the management level, and then up to the local level in terms of implementation. Very interesting. And it dovetails nicely with an interesting piece at Medium.com, Why Two Decades of Pandemic Planning Has Failed. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the author of that piece, Judge Glock. He is a senior policy analyst for the Cicero Institute. And he's got a name like he's an action hero as well. That's a great name. Judge Glock, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Dan. Real pleasure.
You know, we've talked about it on the show before, this sort of like, why didn't we prepare? And there's been John Solomon over at justthenews.com went through two decades of plans that have been prepared. We've talked to people who are part of bipartisan task force a decade ago. The legislation that was passed, the reports that have been written, and you get to it in a way that is a little bit different and I think helpful in terms of understanding why pandemic planning failed. It's not because there was too little. In a sense, it's because there was too much.
Yes, that's what I tried to look at here. I was a little surprised at the number of commentators saying that we didn't have a plan or that they hadn't really planned for this activity, because I knew just from a cursory early look, this is not my main area of expertise, but I do with a lot of different kinds of government policies, that there had been numerous acts passed by Congress about planning, numerous plans issued. And when I looked into it, you really found what you could fairly call dozens of different plans issued over the past 20 years, all dealing with pandemic influenza, pandemics in general, potential epidemics, how the government was going to respond to them. And one of the most depressing things was that none of the plans, or most of the plans, didn't even refer back to each other. A lot of the authors of the plans didn't be aware of the other plans. And those plans that were written and issued didn't seem to have any real clear rules for what the federal government should do in the actual crisis. It was more a lot of vague verbiage about what they hoped would happen. And so all these contradictory plans probably, if anything, inhibited the federal government's response rather than helping it.
So it strikes me as a classic case of agencies operating in silos. And so you have all these reports, but there's no chain of command because there's no interagency communication to synthesize everything into something that's actually actionable.
Exactly. So one of the other problems, as you mentioned, with the plans is that these were usually created in all of these different agencies with little thought about how they would be combined or coordinated. And the attempts the federal government set up to coordinate, if anything, might have even exacerbated the problem. So I mentioned after this 2006 Pandemic Preparedness Act, the government created a new position called the Assistant Secretary for Pandemic Preparedness and Response. It sounds exactly like the person who would be running and coordinating the show right now, a man named Robert Catholic. And you'd think that would sort of be the point person for it, at least according to the congressional response. But as I went through, there seemed to be at least half a dozen, maybe a dozen other point persons that were supposed to run it, including the Secretary of Health and Human Services, the director of the Centers for Disease Control, the director of the Federal Emergency Management Administration. All of these different people were all told that they were supposed to be in charge of this, and they all had plans to prepare for exactly that. And then when the actual crisis hit, it turned out that no one knew exactly who was in charge. And, of course, that exacerbated the problem.
And you have recommendations for the inevitable postmortem that will come with respect to this viral outbreak and the response, beginning with applying the Hippocratic Oath to Congress.
Yeah, I said, if anything else, one of the first things we should learn is do no harm. One of the first of these Pandemic Preparedness Act was passed after the avian flu scare in 2005, and then there was 2009 another scare, and then after the Ebola scare, and each time they pass another act that's going to add one more new agency or one more new plan. And first thing they should do is look at it and say, well, we don't need another new plan. We have these dozens of plans that I won't bore your listeners with. And we have all these different agencies talking across purpose. Anything, we should slim down the number of these agencies. And some things like this assisted Secretary for Pandemic Preparedness probably should go, because they've just become one more sort of roadblock for implementation. And they really need to clarify the lines of the authorities in control and slim down those sort of unnecessary positions.
And also clarifying executive power here, you suggest amending the much talked about National Emergency Act of 1976. What, in which direction should it be amended?
Well, so one of the things I recommend is just, of course, expanding it to allow clarification of bureaucratic lines of control in the next emergency. So there should be what used to be called reorganization authority. It's something we had for about 50, 60 years in the federal government that gave the president a periodic ability to reorganize some overlapping bureaucracies with the approval of Congress, usually with the potential for congressional veto. So something like that would obviously help an emergency. And the other thing I recommend is that sort of separate the power of the presidential emergency declaration from the implementation of it. So there's a lot of concern for people, understandable, about the president declaring an emergency in any administration and then exercising increased power from that emergency. So if I suggest the president declares the emergency, then power gets transferred to one of these agencies that's hopefully clarified ahead of time as the lead director of the response. So in that way, the president can look at when there's a time for an emergency, and then they can have, they know exactly who's supposed to coordinate it, but it'll be outside the president, so there won't be complaints or concerns about a power grab.
He is Judge Glock. He's senior policy analyst for the Cicero Institute. His piece, Why Two Decades of Pandemic Planning Failed, will be tweeted out by me at Dan Prof Show. Judge Glock, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Real pleasure.
Take care.
Listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Well, it's said that the way to a man is through his stomach, as the way to a dictator through the eyes of his chef. Fascinating new angle on some of the 20th century's most evil people who racked up the biggest body counts, the totalitarians the world over, from Saddam Hussein to Idi Amin to Pol Pot to Ho Chi to Fidel Castro. From our next guest, he is Witold Szablowski. He's the author of How to Feed a Dictator, and he looked at all of those dictators I just mentioned through the eyes of their cooks. A combination, as I understand it, of third-person reports as well as first-person interviews. Witold Szablowski, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure. It's not only first-hand reports, but you also have some recipes in the book.
Oh, recipes. Okay, well, you could eat like a dictator, too. I guess that may be probably good eating, although it's... It's just, I don't know, the whole thing just gives me the chills a little bit thinking about the individuals that these chefs serve. But nonetheless, the impetus for this idea is because it's a rather unique angle into the mind of all of these terrible people.
Well, the chefs, they were really close to the dictators and they knew them quite well. And I very quickly understood that the chef has a really unusual perspective, because he's a person that the dictator cannot hide too much from. Like a dictator, he can lie to his people. He can lie to the whole nation. But there are two people that he cannot actually lie to. The first is his personal doctor, and the second is his personal chef. Because, like, if you start lying to the guy who's cooking for you, he will cook something, you know, that will, you want to be healthy. Like, food is everything. Food is life. So if you start lying to your chef, you either starve or you won't live too long.
I was thinking, in real time, maybe Kim Jong-un got across with his chef, and his chef helped put him away, if that's indeed the fact. We don't know, but it'd be fascinating to get insight from his chef, just thinking about the dictators of present day.
I mean, that's what actually all the chefs were, all the dictators were always scared about, that the chef, the guy that they trust, might try to poison them. But if I was looking for this kind of cases in the history, so I was trying to find a chef who would tell me, like, yes, I tried to kill the guy because he was a bloody dictator, I hated what he was doing, and I was trying to kill him. I didn't find such a person living. Now, I only heard about people who are already dead. Like, now, I only found the names of the people who were killed for that attempt.
In your review and your research for the book, did you find any of the dictators who had like tasters to make sure, you know, redundancies?
Yeah, all of them. They had tasters. And Some of them even had their whole laboratories. Like Fidel Castro had like 200 people working and checking the food for him. It was a whole laboratory with X-rays, with some complicated procedures. So but it also, there were testers included, but tester was actually the last person that when the food was out of the laboratory, just in case the taster was giving like the last try before it was the food was served to Fidel. And some were very simple about that. Like Saddam Hussein, he also had the laboratory. Fidel had the laboratory. But for example, Enver Hoxha, dictator, like he was a communist dictator of Albania. He was right. From the same gang like Nicolae Ceausescu or Erich Honecker. And he just had his nurse trying the food before it was served to him. But each of them had his own tester.
When we come back with Vital Shlavsky, author of How to Feed a Dictator, looking at these totalitarian dictators from the 20th century through the eyes of their cooks, we'll get into more comparisons between the cooks for the dictators. More with Vital Shlavsky right after this.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Vital Shlavsky. He is the author of the book How to Feed a Dictator, Saddam Hussein, Idi Amin, Enver Hoxha, Fidel Castro, and Pol Pot Through the Eyes of Their Cooks. There's probably, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 dictators. There's probably 5 movie scripts in this book from the eyes of the cooks. You could do a series probably just because of the uniqueness and, of course, horror of these individuals. But you were talking about the differences between how the relationships between these dictators and their cooks. Which of these dictators would you say had the closest relationship with their chef, and how did that manifest itself?
Well, that would be Fidel Castro, because the guy that cooked for him and the guy I mentioned in an interview for the book is Erasmo Hernandez. He cooked for Fidel for over 50 years, but actually his career, if I may call it this way, began when, as a teenager, as a 14-year-old guy, he joined the revolution. The revolution, like Fidel wasn't in Havana yet. He wasn't the leader of Cuba. He was just a guerrilla, leader of guerrilla that was in the mountains, Sierra
yes,
Maestra.
Right.
And young boy called Erasmo Hernandez joined the revolution. Firstly, he joined the troop of Che Guevara. Very quickly, he became one of the bodyguards of Che Guevara. Che really liked him. And when they invented Havana, and when they began, when they took the power, Che gave this young boy as a present to Fidel. Like, he liked him so much that he gave him as a gift. So he became Fidel's bodyguard. But he told me that he was always complaining, because with Fidel, he was always hungry. And he was from a quite well-off family. So he was used to good food, and he didn't like that. Fidel was chaotic, and he didn't eat breakfast. He was forgetting about lunch. He never had a proper dinner, and this young guy didn't like that. So he began taking a pot. Whenever they were going with Fidel, he would take a pot with him and would prepare something, which officially that was for Fidel, but unofficially that was actually for Erasmo to not be hungry. And they were very close. Like, they spent together 50 years, and that was amazing when I was interviewing Erasmo in Havana, and Fidel was still alive. And I was at his home, and in the fridge at his home, he had some food prepared for Fidel. So twice a week, there was a car coming from Fidel's private house. He was not in power anymore. He didn't have any power. But twice a week, Erasmo was cooking for him.
Well, so this is interesting, you know, because you right. So the Fidel Castro's chef was ideologically aligned. He, you know, he wasn't some like Batista acolyte or something. And so that made sense. And I wonder then, did all the dictators have an ideological purity test for their cooks? Or did you hear from some of the chefs that, you know, basically the Nuremberg defense, I work for a terrible person, but I was just doing my job?
I must say that for some reason, I think they were honest with me. I didn't hear something like that. I didn't hear such a excuses like, oh, I don't know what this guy was actually doing.
So you're saying that they were just
no, that
like,
was only one. That was only one trying to
deny
that she didn't believe. Yeah, denying. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was only the chef of Pol Pot. That's a very unique story because the chef of Pol Pot, her name is Yang Nguyen, the chef of Pol Pot, who was denying all the crimes and all the mass killing and all the genocide that committed Pol Pot, the genocide on his own nation, because Pol Pot killed over 2 million Khmer.
Yes, right.
And his chef is denying all of this, you know, trying to say that bad people are blackmailing our great Pol Pot, our great leader. And there is only one explanation for that. And the explanation is that Yang Nguyen, the chef of Pol Pot, has been in love with him through her whole life. And she's already almost 8 years old, and she's in love with him until today. And it's the story of Pol Pot and his chef is an amazing love story, because this is a love to a guy who committed a genocide.
And for those that are not blinded by love, I guess, as the case with Pol Pot and his chef, the others, if they knew who their bosses were and acknowledged what they did, what do they have to say about that?
Well, it's, for example, the chef of Saddam Hussein. A couple of times he's mentioning that working for Saddam had never been his dream. Like, he was dreaming about working in a 5-star hotel. That's why he became a chef. He never wanted to cook for a president. But he was chosen for the job by a secret service. He was never actually asked. And he says, like, could I quit this job? I asked him a couple of times, but also he is going back to the topic. And he was always answering, maybe I could, but I didn't have the courage to ask.
Right.
Like, he was damn scared. Like, he saw Saddam killing people, and he didn't want to be killed. So he didn't feel like asking Saddam, hey, can I leave this position because I don't like cooking for you? So he kept doing this for over 20 years. And actually, he found the courage, but that was after after the American invasion to Iraq, like when he was really, really tired of cooking, of all the bombardments, of hiding. And then finally he asked Saddam that maybe that's the moment he could leave the job. But before he was so afraid of cooking for Saddam Hussein.
Well, sure. Like any crime family, once you're in, you're in. There's no retirement. He is Witold Szabowski. He is the author of How to Feed a Dictator, Saddam Hussein, Idi Amin, Enver Hoxha, Fidel Castro, and Pol Pot Through the Eyes of Their Cooks. Fascinating angle in to these dastardly dictators from the 20th century. Witold Szabowski, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with the book. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Fly.
more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Just some odds and ends to wrap up, non-COVID-19 related. Some good news for General Michael Flynn, apparently. Federalist.com reporting over the weekend per conversations they had with well-placed sources about Department of Justice filings in the Flynn case that they suggest, Federalist.com reports, contain exculpatory information about Michael Flynn. So President Trump tweeted that he's considering a full pardon for Flynn. May not be necessary if what the Federalist is reporting is indeed the case. On the bad news front, if you're Joe Biden or a fan, development in the matter of the allegations of sexual assault by former Biden Senate staffer Tara Reid, which we have covered on this show, against Joe Biden. Video from 1993 Larry King show in which a woman calls in to inquire about channels for reporting, for remediation for a staffer who is abused by a senator. And Tara Reid says that this is her mom who called in.
Yes, hello. I'm wondering what a staffer would do besides go to the press in Washington. My daughter has just left there after working for a prominent senator and could not get through with her problems at all. And the only thing she could have done was go to the press, and she chose not to do it out of respect for him.
Or she had a story to tell, but out of respect for the person she worked for, she didn't tell it.
That's true.
So if that is indeed Tara Reid's mom, I mean, I would think she knows what her mom sounds like. Her mom has since passed, so you can't corroborate it with her. This goes to corroborating her story. Did she tell anyone in real time, in not back in 1993 when this alleged assault was to have occurred? You've got now that potential call, if it's verified that that's her mom, that actual call, but if it's verified. You've got one friend that New York Times reported said that friend was told by Tara Reid at the time of the allegation. You've also got her brother providing some corroboration. And then somebody else in 2008 suggesting that she had confided in that person as well as to the allegations against Joe Biden. So this may not be going away anytime soon, much as the D.C. press corps tried to ignore it for so long. And we will keep you updated on that. To close the show, I just want to offer another viewing recommendation in addition to No Safe Spaces. I mentioned it before. There's a new series out, documentary series, Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, which is a documentary that presents convincing evidence the biblical account of the Exodus is true. There are three different films in this series, Exodus, The Moses Controversy, and The Red Sea Miracle. Investigative filmmaker Tim Mahoney journeyed to Egypt, Israel, and throughout the world to search for answers to the very important question, did the stories like Exodus, as written in the Bible, really happen? Right now, you can watch Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, at home, along with other movies in the series, at patternsofevidence.com. Watch Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, and others in the series. Go to patternsofevidence.com. That's patternsofevidence.com. And thank you for joining us on another edition of The Dan Proft Show. Please do so again tomorrow.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is The Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.